Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Jerry Condon, former president and current national board member of Veterans for Peace, who discusses the tragic shooting of two National Guard soldiers in Washington, D.C., and allegations of Trump Pentagon war crimes being committed in international waters. Journalist and author Sasha Abramski, who assesses the state of U.S. democracy 10 months after Trump's return to the White House, and the belief by some that we're now seeing the unraveling of the Trump GOP authoritarian regime, and Wanda Bertram of the Prison Policy Initiative, who talks about her group's new report that lists 34 criminal legal system reform bills that have succeeded in being passed by state legislatures. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Of the world's last remaining rainforests, the Congo Basin is the second largest, but this vast region, often called the lungs of Africa, is largely overlooked when it comes to climate policy and allocation of funds to protect its vital resources. Spanning across six nations in Central Africa, the basin is home to some 130 million people and thousands of rare species. While deforestation and mining are increasing in the Congo, most of the forest remains untouched. The Guardian reports that this region is believed to be the planet's last big rainforest, with enough trees left to absorb more carbon than it emits. While scientists agree on the Congo Basin's critical importance, it continues to receive funding for forest protection and research at a far lower rate than the Earth's other remaining rainforests in the Amazon, New Guinea, and Borneo. The Republic of Congo's environment minister declared, "Supporting the Congo Basin is not charity. It's about recognizing its role in protecting the Earth through its carbon sink." 1 year ahead of the midterm election, the campaign has already begun in Nebraska's swing 2nd Congressional District, where incumbent anti-abortion Republican Don Bacon is retiring. The Congressional Progressive Caucus made an early endorsement of State Senator John Kavanaugh. In the primary, his chief opponent is former CEO and Democratic activist Denise Powell, who has close ties to national moderate Democratic donors. Although the Nebraska 2nd District voted for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, its congressional seat has remained in Republican hands. Kavanaugh has a strong political brand in Nebraska and is supported by the party establishment, progressive activists, and unions. Powell, who trains women to run for local office, is positioning herself as a pragmatic cultural liberal with private sector experience. Democrats last won the Nebraska's 2nd in 2014. Both Democratic candidates talk about the affordability crisis and protecting health insurance coverage from Trump and the GOP's deep cuts. The race is shaping up to be a novel showdown between two unique coalitions, the local establishment and populist progressives on one side, and the national donor class and moderates on the other. The uranium mining industry that boomed in the Cold War years was built mostly on or near Navajo lands by the federal government rushing to get materials for nuclear weapons and later nuclear energy plants. But Navajo communities weren't informed of the danger to their health, and it left a trail of sickness and death for those who worked in the mines and mills and for those who drank poisoned water and breathed poisoned air. The U.S. government is now gearing up to reopen uranium mines in New Mexico on or near Navajo territory 50 years after most mines were abandoned. Uranium is needed to build a new generation of nuclear weapons that will cost nearly $1 trillion, even as sick Navajo miners and their families have never been compensated for their pain and suffering. In These Times reports that across Navajo lands, there are 523 abandoned uranium mines, but not a single mine has been fully remediated and made safe. Leona Morgan, an indigenous community organizer based in Albuquerque, vows, "No new mines and no new weapons until contaminated soil and water have been cleaned up, put into permanent storage, and monitored." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
An ambush shooting attack on November 25th, targeting two West Virginia National Guard soldiers just blocks from the White House, killed Army Specialist Sarah Beckstrom and severely wounded Air Force Staff Sergeant Andrew Wolf. The suspect in the shooting, Ramanullah Lakhanwal, was a member of a CIA Zero unit, an elite squad of Afghans that killed and captured suspected terrorists. In response, President Trump announced a series of extreme measures barring Afghans from entering the U.S., pausing all asylum decisions for migrants now in the country, and reviewing the green card status of people from 19 nations. Meanwhile, a bipartisan group of lawmakers are calling for an investigation into the Trump regime's bombing of 22 alleged drug smuggling boats in the Caribbean and Pacific, which have resulted in at least 83 deaths. In a Washington Post report that Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth had given a verbal order to kill survivors of a September 2nd U.S. boat strike. The former Fox News host, who now calls himself Secretary of War, later shifted responsibility for the order to Admiral Frank Bradley, while supporting the decision to kill all survivors aboard that boat. These revelations came just days after six Democratic legislators posted a video message to U.S. soldiers advising them that they have a legal obligation to refuse to carry out unlawful or unconstitutional orders from superiors. Trump labeled the six traitors who should be arrested, tried, and face execution. The FBI has since launched an inquiry into the six lawmakers, and the Pentagon is investigating Arizona U.S. Senator Mark Kelly, a Navy captain, announcing he may be recalled to face a court-martial. Your reporter spoke with Jerry Condon, a Vietnam-era veteran, the former president, and current national board member of Veterans for Peace. Here he responds to the lethal attack on the two National Guard soldiers in Washington, D.C., and allegations of Trump Pentagon war crimes committed in the bombing of small boats in international waters.
The position of Veterans for Peace is that the National Guard should not be deployed to any U.S. cities, nor should any active duty military. In fact, it's an illegal deployment, violates the Posse Comitatus Act and the U.S. Constitution. To be deploying U.S. troops in U.S. domestically in U.S. cities for law enforcement purposes, unless there is a quote-unquote significant insurrection. Of course, Trump will tell you there's an insurrection going on everywhere. The lies of this administration are just epic. Another aspect of this that needs to be examined, of course, as is widely known now and publicized, the man who carried out the attack was said to be mentally troubled, but he's probably troubled by the experience he had in Afghanistan. He was part of an Afghan military unit that worked very, very closely with the CIA, where they had night raids and targeted killings of high-level Taliban commanders and whatnot. So it's kind of a classic example of the violence coming home from abroad, coming home to haunt the country from where it emanated. Veterans for Peace certainly sends their sympathies to the families, especially of this young woman who's passed away. She's only 20 years old, and by all accounts, a wonderful young woman who, you know, thought she was serving her country. And the young man who's, I guess, still fighting for his life. And it's really atrocious that their tragic deaths are being immediately jumped upon by Trump to further his attacks on immigrants not just Afghan immigrants, but now he's saying he's not going to let any immigrants in from the so-called third world, and he's just upping the ante.
Jerry, as many of our listeners are aware, the Washington Post and other outlets have reported that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth ordered a second strike on an alleged drug smuggling boat in September after the commanders on the scene reported that there were two survivors. If true, of course, this is likely a war crime. And so far, 22 boats have been destroyed by the U.S. military, with the reports I've read said 83 people have died. And we don't know how many in this matter of standing orders that survivors should be killed. What's your reaction to hearing this news?
Well, I'm glad that the media is paying attention. Apparently, there's bipartisan call in the Congress for an investigation. And that's very encouraging also. I mean, the fact that these two people were clinging to a boat that had already been destroyed, and then they were ordered to be killed and were killed by the U.S. military. I mean, it's outright murder on defenseless people. What I find a little curious, though, is I don't think that's any more illegal or outrageous than the initial strike on all these boats. And many human rights groups around the country or around the world are saying these are illegal strikes. These are war crimes if there's actually a war involved. And if there's no war involved, then these are just outright criminal actions. It's mass murder on the high seas. As far as we know, none of these boats were armed. Some of them may or may not have had a certain amount of cocaine or something that was being transported from one place to another nearby island. Some of these were just fishing boats. In one case, I heard the AP did a story and showed that there was a fisherman who makes $100 a month to support his family. And, you know, he's told, hey, I'll give you $500 just to drive this boat over to the a nearby island with the cargo here. And he took the offer. And next thing you know, he's assassinated without any due process by the United States. So this is totally outrageous, as is the ongoing threat to overthrow the government of Venezuela with U.S. military force.
That was Jerry Condon, a Vietnam-era veteran, the former president, and current national board member of Veterans for Peace. Find more analysis and commentary on U.S. attacks on alleged drug smuggling boats that observers say are war crimes by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. More than 10 months into Donald Trump's second term, there's little debate that this twice-impeached convicted felon president is aggressively pursuing a hardline authoritarian agenda that was laid out in detail in the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025. Trump and the Republican Party have blatantly defied the U.S. Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the rule of law by dismantling large parts of the federal government as they've defunded cancer, Alzheimer's, and vaccine research, and massively cut federal health insurance programs that millions of working families rely on. Trump has deployed a massed ICE secret police force that violently abducts non-citizens and citizens alike, denying many their due process rights, and ordered the prosecution of his perceived political enemies, labeling many as terrorists, while calling for Democratic legislators to be executed. As he's abused his presidential power to repress free speech by using the Federal Communications Commission to threaten media companies, Trump has also ordered the erasing of America's history of slavery and Jim Crow racism in national museums. But in recent weeks, congressional Republicans have abandoned Trump in his effort to block the release of the Epstein files. GOP candidates across the country lost key elections in November, and the president's approval rating in recent polls has dropped to its lowest level in his second term. Some observers are declaring that Trump is now a lame duck president who may soon lose even the solid support he's long enjoyed from a shrinking right-wing base. Your reporter spoke with journalist and author Sasha Abramski, who assesses the state of U.S. democracy after Trump's return to the White House, and responds to the belief by some that the nation may now be witnessing the unraveling of the Trump GOP authoritarian nightmare.
Look, we've been in a constitutional crisis since day one of this presidency, because Trump came into power as a convicted felon. He came into power with a Supreme Court ruling basically saying he could do anything And as long as he said it was in his official capacity, he was outside the scope of the law. And he has the temperament of a tyrant. So if you put all of those things together, and you then look at his agenda, you look at what he's done, as you said, with the secret police, you look at what he's done with his assaults on the universities and the free media, you look at what he's done with his prosecution or persecution of political enemies. I mean, this is not a democracy that Trump is trying to implement. This is the creation of an authoritarian state. You look at what rights and what constitutional amendments Trump is trampling on. Well, the First Amendment, he has scant respect for, if any respect for. The Fifth Amendment, the right not to self-incriminate. The Fourth Amendment, the right against illegal search and seizure. The Eighth Amendment, the right against cruel and unusual punishment. He sent hundreds of people to a super maximum security prison in El Salvador with no trial, no due process, where he knew they would be tortured. So bang goes the Eighth Amendment. You can go down the list and you find pretty much the only constitutional amendment Trump respects is the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, which he not only respects but fetishizes. So we've been in a constitutional crisis from day one. I was sort of half joking with a friend of mine a few weeks ago that if the Democrats regain control of Congress, they should basically set aside 2 hours every afternoon to hold a new impeachment hearing. Because we know that on a daily basis, there are going to be impeachable offenses committed by this regime, whether they are crimes, whether they're corruption and cronyism, whether it's violence, whether it's the illegal deportation of people with no due process, whether it's the breaking up of families, whether it's the arresting of people with green cards, not because of crimes they've committed, but because of thoughts that they've had. We know that this is an extra legal regime. And we have to discuss it that way. This is not normal governance. This is not the normal rough and tumble of politics. This is something different. This is something that America has never experienced before. It is a full-on authoritarian assault on the pillars of democracy.
Trump now has the lowest public opinion approval ratings of his second term, about as low as after Trump incited the violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, that took several lives. Americans, it appears, are unhappy with most of Trump's authoritarian agenda, but most of all, they disapprove of his handling of the economy and rising prices, the very reason a very slim majority of voters cast their ballots for Trump in November 2024. Sasha, is this the beginning of the end of Trump's presidency, you know, at least in terms of being a lame duck, which he's labeled by many now, at least in terms of the Republican Party, who have followed his every order? Out of fear. Are they losing that fear? And do you think things are falling apart, or is that just wishful thinking?
There are many leaders, some left-wing, some right-wing, some populist, some non-populist around the world, who when they come into power initially ride a wave of popularity, and then very quickly the public gets disillusioned. That almost seems to be a sort of crisis in modern politics around the world. The fact that Trump's underwater politically doesn't necessarily mean he's not powerful. He is powerful. He still has a lock on the Republican Party. He's got this extra legal agenda that we've just been talking about, and he's perfectly willing to push every constitutional boundary he can push to implement that agenda. But where I think you are right is that as his popularity fades, and it's going to get worse and worse and worse, there's no evidence that he's suddenly going to rebound and become a hero. He's going to get more and more unpopular. And as he does so, it's going to become possible for at least some Republicans to sort of at first gingerly and then maybe not so gingerly stand up to him and say, you know what, you can't do this. And you're starting to see this a little bit. Rand Paul has been pretty good in calling out the administration for this assassination campaign of fishermen in the Pacific and the Caribbean. You're starting to see people who are expressing their displeasure, again, a little bit timidly, but they're starting to express their displeasure with the sheer battiness of Robert Kennedy at the Health Department. You're starting to see people who are sort of pushing back, you know, again, ever so slightly against Trump's plans to essentially carve up Ukraine with Russia. You know, whether or not that coalesces into a sort of strong anti-Trump movement within the Republican Party, I doubt it. And the reason I doubt it is he has been very, very good at making the Republican Party complicit in his crimes, which means they rise or fall with him. If he goes down for naked, brazen corruption, which he should go down for, the Republican Party will go down with him. If he goes down for breaking the economy, which he could well do with this idiot policy of tariffs that he's implementing, the Republican Party has twisted itself into pretzel knots supporting that tariff policy. They go down with him. So I think they're too complicit to be able to make a clean break. But I do think what's going to happen is you're going to have increasingly loud voices within the MAGA movement sort of angling to be the heirs apparent, because everyone knows Trump's not going to be around forever. He's an old man. He's not terribly healthy. He's giving every sign of being increasingly senescent. At some point, we're going to be in a post-Trump world. And you're starting to see all of these players within MAGA positioning themselves, trying to be the next hotshot. And that's sort of both fascinating and also kind of nauseating at the same time. Mm. But I think that's more likely than an absolute break within the Republican sort of Senate and Congress away from Trump. I don't see that happening.
That was journalist and author Sasha Abramski. His new book, American Carnage, How Trump, Musk, and Doge Butchered the U.S. Government, will be published in January. Find links to Abramski's recent articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The U.S. criminal legal system suffers from so many health and human rights abuses that many advocates have stopped calling it the criminal justice system. The Prison Policy Initiative is a nonprofit that researches many of these problems and proposes solutions. The group has just released a report titled Winnable Criminal Justice Reforms in 2026. The report lists 34 criminal legal system reforms and model legislation that can and have succeeded in being passed by state legislatures across the U.S. The group acknowledges that the report this year comes at a time when hard-won past criminal legal system reforms are under coordinated attack by the Trump administration and Congress, as well as governors and state legislators of both political parties. Some policymakers, the group maintains, are determined to return to the failed tough-on-crime policies that defined the 1990s. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with a Prison Policy Initiative's communication strategist, Wanda Bertram, who describes the 8 arenas for action and some specific proposals detailed in the report.
We do this report every year. It's called Winnable Criminal Justice Reforms. And what we do in it is aggregate a list of criminal justice reforms that have succeeded in state legislatures that we believe have the potential to succeed in more state legislatures. And we send this out to several hundred state legislators across the country as a way of encouraging them to pursue criminal justice reform and also to give them a reference sheet for what can actually be done. Because obviously right now, we're not in a moment where a lot of people have progressive offensive reform strategies on their minds. A lot of legislators and advocates are playing defense as the federal government and state lawmakers also seek to roll back a lot of what's been done in, kind of across the board politically, but, you know, including lots of criminal justice reforms like bail reform. But nevertheless, we do see that there are still areas where legislators can work with pre-existing legislation and get their colleagues on board with things that are just common sense. So we put this report together as kind of a reference sheet for those folks. This year, we have about a little over 30 reforms that we suggest. It's not a comprehensive criminal justice reform platform, right? We're not laying out here our vision for the perfect system. What we're doing is curating reforms that we think can win and that don't allocate more resources, vastly more resources, to the criminal legal system. We're trying to make the criminal legal system fairer without making it bigger. And so things like, you know, building bigger jails or building, you know, shiny new jails that have more state-of-the-art services, you won't find those in our report.
Don't they fall into 8 categories? Is that right? And can you just run them down and then we're going to focus on a few?
So the categories that we're looking at: expanding alternatives to criminal legal system responses to social problems, protecting the presumption of innocence, decreasing the length of prison sentences. These are all kind of ways of either diverting people from the criminal legal system or getting them out of prison if they are there and don't need to be. We also have a couple sections about the conditions in prisons, treating people humanely during incarceration and treating people on supervision fairly. We have a section about setting people up to succeed in reentry so that they don't come back to prison. And then we have a section about giving incarcerated and formerly incarcerated people a political voice. So that has to do with things like voting and also with prison gerrymandering. And then finally, we have a section about reducing spending on the criminal legal system and increasing investments in communities.
Just as a quick note, prison gerrymandering is, I guess, when prisoners are counted for voting purposes, for allocating representation, are counted as residents of the prison rather than residents of where they come from. Is that right?
That's correct. And it leads to a disproportionate electoral power being given to communities that host prisons and taken away from communities that send people to prison.
Absolutely. Let's just focus in on a few of these.
What we recommend in our report is a combination of things, right? States have a few options. One of those options is called second look sentencing. It's a reform that allows courts, and this can work a couple of different ways, but it allows courts to take a second look at the sentence that was given to someone who's already served a certain amount of it. There's a federal congressional bill. This would allow federal courts to revisit the sentence of anyone who has served more than 10 years behind bars. A surprising number of states, I believe 14, have some kind of second look sentencing in place. Those kinds of policies, they basically create a way out of the system for people who were sentenced by laws or at a time when the system was very punitive and maybe punitive in ways that we don't consider to be fair or just anymore. States can also expand good time credits, and that's a system that allows people to earn their way out of prison earlier through good behavior or participating in programs. You can also expand compassionate release. That's something that states might choose to do if they're trying to target populations of people with more health issues, right? So narrowing down the criteria to people who are terminally ill or facing, you know, some kind of a serious infirmity. This is not just something that legislators should think about doing out of the kindness of their hearts. It's also something that makes a lot of sense from a financial standpoint and also just from, you know, a logistical standpoint, because prisons are very quickly these days turning into nursing homes for quite a lot of people.
That was Wanda Bertram, communication strategist with the Prison Policy Initiative. Find a link to the group's Winnable Criminal Justice Reforms in 2026 report by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on KKFI in Kansas City, Missouri, KSER in Everett, Washington, Progressive Voices Network nationwide, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.